Hello and welcome to The Sound Off, a podcast where school safety takes center stage. My name is Michelle Gay, and I'm the co-founder and executive director of Safe and Sound Schools. We're committed to protecting every school and every student every day. In today's episode, we're exploring the critical and often complex process of long-term recovery in schools after disaster. We'll be focusing on the resilience and renewal of school communities post-crisis, drawing insights from real-world experiences. Before we dive into our discussion, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsors for their support. This season of The Sound Off is brought to you by the Door Security and Safety Foundation, which advances the critical role of certified professionals in creating safe and secure building openings. For more information and to locate an expert, visit www.doorsecuritysafety.org. Joining us today is Dr. CJ Huff, who played a pivotal role in the extraordinary recovery of the Joplin schools following the devastating tornado of 2011. As a former superintendent, CJ's leadership and dedication were instrumental in navigating the challenges and rebuilding efforts in the wake of this disaster. In our conversation, we'll uncover the lessons learned from Joplin, explore the importance of community resilience, and discuss strategies to support schools and students through recovery and beyond. Welcome, CJ Huff. It's so great to have you on The Sound Off. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for the invite.
I'm always amazed. It's where in the world is CJ? It's a little game that we play on the Safe and Sound team. You are so busy out and about helping communities. So just for fun, where are you today?
I am in Lahaina, Maui.
Wow.
I got here last Friday and I actually leave a little bit later today.
Well, I'm glad to know that you're there. I know that the needs are pretty extraordinary, and they will be for a long time. And I'm grateful that you're there to serve and help folks kind of find their way forward.
It's quite an honor every time I get to go out and do these things, just meeting these people that are going through a lot, but you know, the strength that they have. And because I work with schools primarily, just being around educators and that love kids, and they're doing anything and everything they can to support their kids and their staff. And it's always just really a humbling experience to be a part of.
I'm just so proud, really, vicariously, knowing that you're there doing that work. But we'll get to all that good stuff. Before we do, we're going to start with something silly, because we're going to talk about some, you know, heavy stuff. But it is always fun for our listeners to get to know you as we do. Tell us something funny about you. What is your stupid human trick, your superpower, your secret superpower that people would be surprised to know about you?
I've got several. Being a dad, I've got the stupid dad joke superpower. So that's probably one of my best ones. So there's that. But probably, you know, I'm a farmer, you know, growing up, so I can drive just about anything, fix about anything. So, you know, I drive tractors, semis, I can weld. I still, even to this day, I like to work with my hands, and just finished close to finished renovating the house we just moved into about a year ago. And if it can be fixed, I can fix it.
I do think that would surprise people, because most folks know you as Dr. CJ Huff. You know, you're scholarly. You, you know, served.
I've been called a lot of things. Scholarly is not one of them, typically. So.
Oh, yeah. There's this outward perception, right? Having served as a superintendent. But yeah, it's pretty amazing the skill set that you have and the growing up and how that continues. So cool. Thank you for sharing that with us, Mr. Fix It. We appreciate that. You know, you go in and you help people pick up, clean up, fix up, find forward, whatever it takes in a lot of communities. And I know, because I've known you for a long time, it's not necessarily work that you thought or maybe even wanted to be part of when you set out in your professional career. But one of the things that you do most often is help communities in long-term recovery. So we're going to talk about long-term recovery while you're sitting with us in Hawaii. And before we get into that, I think it's important to kind of establish some common ground. So when we talk about long-term recovery, particularly in terms of the school community, what are we talking about? What does that mean?
First of all, probably give a little bit of context on how I got into this work.
Yeah.
You're right. I never anticipated being in long-term recovery work. In fact, if I were to go back 15 years ago, I would tell you I'd be a superintendent of school somewhere and be working with teachers and kids and probably still be in Joplin, Missouri, where I was superintendent. And for those that didn't know, I was superintendent when the EF5 tornado hit Joplin on May 22nd, 2011, and destroyed six of my schools, did damage to four others. The loss of life was very significant. And going through that long-term recovery work for 4 years, and in 2015, I retired from the superintendency. I tried to get away from everything recovery, because that's not what I got in the business for, and I went so far as to try to rebrand myself, because everybody knew me for the work that I did around the tornado. And I was trying really hard not to do this kind of work, but I kept getting pulled back into it. And the more I fought it, the more miserable I was. And so I finally gave in and fallen in love with the work, and just being able to go out and help communities and be a small part of that long-term recovery effort. And hopefully with a little bit of guidance can provide them some insight into what to expect, where the resources are to get the support that they need, what questions they need to be asking. And so everything from, emotional health, mental health, leadership, to helping them find resources to support long-term recovery work.
And that long-term recovery, I mean, you've served within the Safe and Sound post-crisis, support network with FEMA, with HHS, with all kinds of different agencies and groups. And that kind of work is obviously not just tornadoes, right? A lot of people think of a natural disaster like a tornado. They're thinking of you because of your lived experiences. But right now you're in Hawaii. So we're talking about recovering the school community from really just about anything, right?
Yeah. And, natural disaster wise and, what you experience with, I'll call it man-made disaster. Yeah. It's different. It's very different than that kind of work. Just what that short-term, recovery and long-term recovery. There's some commonalities, obviously, but
right.
Just the community reaction and how people start moving from that response, initial response phase into that long-term recovery effort. And like Lahaina right now, their disaster was back in August, and tremendous loss of life, tremendous devastation. And what I'd say right now, based on the conversations that I've been having, is they've kind of moved through that initial response phase, and they're just now starting to kind of have that language of long-term recovery, where they're starting to really look ahead and trying to figure out the what's next piece. So the timing of me being here right now, it's interesting. I come into disasters at a lot of different points in time.
So what are some of the events, crises that our schools are having to recover from?
Here in Lahaina, I'll just use it as a specific example. Right now, everything's focused on students and staff and trying to stabilize their lives, the biggest challenge. And it's, the uniqueness of an island disaster, and I experienced this in Puerto Rico as well, is that the assistance here, the people are on the ground to support, but the materials and resources, it's a little bit harder to get here. And there's this funky thing, and it's called the Jones Act. Any materials that are shipped, they have to go to the continental U.S. first before they can be shipped to and taken to the islands. It's an archaic act that, in my opinion, needs to be changed, but it slows down the recovery process, because anything that comes from overseas that helps support the rebuild has to touch U.S. soil first before it can go to where it's needed. And so right now, housing is a big issue, stable housing. You got families that are living in the hotel that I'm in right now, and hotels all across the island. They're doubled and tripled up, and the dwellings and families that have taken others in. And unfortunately, some folks that left the island and went to the mainland and may or may not be back. I don't know. And so there's that piece. Transportation's an issue. You've got all these homeless children and youth that are scattered across the island that want to continue to come to school with their friends. And so managing transportation's a big challenge. And then just trying to find space.
So it's interesting. I think we're talking long-term recovery, and the bulk of the work that you're doing to help recover school communities from, possibly a crisis that has affected the entire community it's just a lot more than people might think of. So whether it's tornado, tsunami, volcano, these things really do happen, within the United States, especially in our, as you said, island states, wildfires, all of these types of things that our school communities have to recover from. Right. And I think that leads us into, what's it not? What are some of the misconceptions that folks might have about this long-term recovery for the community, and especially the school community? I think there's just mm-hmm. so much that if you're not in the thick of it, you're not realizing what's happening on the day-to-day, minute-to-minute in these communities that are trying to literally pick up from the rubble or the ashes or the earthquake, whatever the disaster was that has heavily impacted their community and therefore their school community.
one of the issues that surfaces, you get a lot of resources on the front end. I mean, there's a lot that comes into it. What's discussed in the media, especially in these big disasters that bring a lot of international attention, you know, the money that's being donated, the items that are being donated. And, you know, remarkably, with all the funds that have been brought in, you know, the big name
concerts,
yeah. You know, the big multi-million dollar donations that come in. And I don't know what the dollar figure is going to be on this disaster, but it's going to be in the billions.
Yeah.
No question, in terms of what the damage was. And some people might think that the community is going to be made whole. These individual families are going to be made whole. There's going to be lots of resources and donations coming in. And that's not the case. You know, insurance is a tough thing for families to navigate. In as much as you'd like to think that insurance is going to make you whole, it really doesn't. You know, there's always gaps. And that's true, not just for the families, but also for the schools. And one misconception out there is that, you know, I'll just use here as an example, that they've got plenty of money now, that there's, right. You know, everything's going to be okay. FEMA's on the ground. And at the end of the day, there's, you know, just being made whole, there's never enough. So then as you get further away from the disaster, there's less and less attention. And then the next disaster happens, and then all the focus goes to that next disaster. And so one of the things I tell folks, and they recognize it even here, I've heard some of this long-term recovery conversation the other day with some of the principals, you know, that basically, you know, I tell folks is, you know, every disaster, whether it's man-made or natural, they start local and they end local. Mm-hmm. And that means, you know, your local people are taking care of each other in the beginning, and you're going to be taking care of each other in the end. And
I've heard you say that many times before. We do a lot of traveling and speaking together, and it really resonates with me, even with our man-made disaster experience and some of the weather impacts we had. We had Hurricane Sandy that really struck us pretty heavily in the Northeast, kind of in the same time as the tragedy that we suffered at Sandy Hook. But that is such a poignant statement to me, because I feel like, you know, you talk about that kind of adrenalized kind of immediate aftermath. There's all this energy and there's attention and there are people everywhere. People come from all over the place to help. Some actually are helpful. Many are like just there, you know, clogging the streets and soaking up some of the resources that the community needs. So there's that complexity. But then eventually that fades and, you know, all those folks return back home, their deployment period ends, whatever it may be, the funding is done, the grant is over. And then to me, that's where the real long-term starts. And you're right, there's financially, there's never enough, but then there's also the whole long-term of the psychological recovery of the community, the reestablishment of the culture. And where you are right now, there is such rich culture and history. And when that place that represented all of that has literally been burned to the ground, the psychological impact of that, of not having your home, your things, the things that were passed down to you from your parents and their parents. There's just a lot of psychology to that long-term recovery as well. Can you bust up a couple of myths for us there too, while you're at it?
One of the things that I see after every disaster, and, you know, you see the community come together, and from an outsider looking in, it's like, wow, they've really got this. And, you know, I think I may have said it before, a lot of adrenaline induced behaviors on the part of the community. And as we all know, adrenaline only take you so far. And
there's that crash. It's going to happen.
You know, at this point in a recovery, that's when you start to see the crash. The exhaustion starts to set in, the reality of where the finish line's really at. There's no clear finish line. A lot of unanswered questions, you know, the what's next in terms of communication and the challenges that, you know, once FEMA gets involved and they try to establish some goals in terms of when things are going to happen. And you guys probably have all experienced this, but if you've ever built anything, it never goes as well as you'd like for it to. I know, Michelle, you've been through this recently. And
yeah.
When we were going through our recovery effort, and it always seems like it was always two more months. And
yes.
Then 2 weeks out, it'd be, well, two more weeks. And that'd go on for a little bit longer too. And so with that comes a lot of frustration, and people just want to get back to normal as quickly as they can.
You know, you use the word finish line, and I think that's one of the myths. I really do. Regardless of the tragedy, the disaster, we all kind of start maybe at that adrenalized time thinking, I don't know where it is, but I know it's there. There's going to be a finish line. There's going to be this demarcation point where we can look back and go, we did it. You know, mm-hmm. Now we can stand on our 2 feet. And we're approaching the 11-year mark for, you know, our recovery journey after Sandy Hook. And we've talked about how it's very different for each individual, as well as there's this kind of like collective journey of the community as well. But I think at some point I came to the realization that there's not really a finish line, that it's like there's just a new phase that we might be entering. And that does bring a sense of relief, like, okay, we're through the phase, kind of like you're describing, like we've actually got potable water, the air is breathable, it's habitable. So we've triaged for the basics, and then we move into another phase where we can tend to another whole slew of needs, like the psychological needs, like the need to reestablish community and cultural ties and those types of things. So I think the idea of that finish line may be one of the myths to this work. There is this persistent myth, you know, insert COVID, insert wildfires, insert man-made disaster, acts of violence, whatever it may be, but somehow there's like some right way to do the recovery thing. I suppose there's that human need in all of us, just tell us what the right way is so that we can do it. We can maybe get there a little bit faster. But the reality is there is really no right way. And the more time we waste judging other people's journeys or needs or, you know, how they're going to get there or how they're progressing, it's just, it's super harmful, wouldn't you say, to the individuals, the community?
It is. And I think that's probably one of the most important things I bring to school community anyway, is an understanding of what that recovery journey looks like, things that they can expect, and an understanding of what they've been through and how they're currently feeling versus where they're going to be at a month from now, 6 months from now. And right now, as they kind of move into this recovery phase, they're in that disillusionment phase that I talk about when I do presentations. They've moved into that, and that the importance of empathy and listening. You don't have to have all the answers right now, and especially if you're in a leadership role.
You mentioned the disillusionment phase, and boy, is that a reality check for communities. Again, it doesn't discriminate. Whatever kind of disaster or tragedy there is a common sort of trajectory. It's not exact. And you and I like to point to that SAMHSA graph. You know, folks out there, just look it up. You know, recovery trajectory, I forget what the name of it is, but it's super easy to find. And it kind of maps these phases. And you talked about the disillusionment phase. The phase before that is the most amazing phase. What is that phase? Tell us about that phase.
Oh, the honeymoon phase. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. It's unfortunately, as you said, it's very short, very short lived. Doesn't last long. And
like, we got this. You see all you know, insert community name, strong. Yeah.
The news media is, news media is right. And I'll tell you though something too, that, and this, and you and I have talked a little bit about this. It looks different after a school shooting than I'm not even sure in many cases there's even, you know, in a school shooting type situation, there is a honeymoon phase.
I'll tell you, we had in the midst of our, it's weird because that honeymoon phase is happening alongside extraordinary grief and loss, just like you would see, you know, in a community post wildfire post. So it's a very strange phase in that there's just extreme rock bottom kind of emotion, but then you look around and the people around you are at their best in many cases, you know, like they are pitching in, they are working around the clock. I talk about in Newtown, like you just couldn't pay for your own gas or coffee because the person in front of you had already paid for it. Like it was, people were just doing a really good job taking care, you know, of each other. So I would, you know, and a lot of colleagues and friends from other communities, post act of violence or school shooting, they still describe that kind of that same phenomenon. It's just kind of happening along with a lot of very extreme emotions of grief and trauma and loss. At the same time.
Yeah. And the one thing I think that's different too is the media coverage, I think, is probably the biggest thing that's different, where it's, you know, that somebody need, you know, they want to blame somebody right away. They, how could this happen? It has to be somebody's fault. You know, is it they didn't have their doors locked, or the police response? And you saw that in Uvalde, where there's a tremendous amount of criticism that came right away. But I think you're right. That's a great way of looking at it, because I think after every disaster, community as a whole pulls together, and the support is there. But from a leadership perspective, I think it's a very different type of situation. In terms of there is no, I don't think there is any that they're going to be looking at you immediately and say, well, how could you have let this happen? Natural disasters are a little different. But that whole recovery piece from a leadership perspective, I think, not having lived that, thank goodness, is a very different animal.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. So, another thing you mentioned is this concept of normal, and my stomach kind of turns to even say it because it's so cliche now, but like the new normal, like we're going to get to our new normal, and there is a normal, and this whole, we're going to get back to normal, all of that. How do you feel about that?
Every time I hear somebody say the new normal, I do cringe a little bit. But that's pretty common language post-disaster. And I think that it's an acknowledgement that things aren't going to be, they're not going to be like they were.
They're not.
And I think that some people don't want the new normal. Some people take offense to that. They want things back the way they were, and they want it yesterday. They want it now.
There's a sense of grief there. People literally are like, no, I'm not going there, and they're angry. And it's like, I refuse. No, we're going to rebuild back better. And we're going to do our standardized tests in the spring. And it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine.
And it's not. And it won't be for a while. I think back to my days in Joplin and what Joplin looks like today versus what it looked like, even our schools, what it looked like before. Are they better? Absolutely. The schools, we've got amazing new schools. We've got a lot of new amenities. But that heart of our community, the tornado ripped right through the middle of our town. And it's very obvious where the tornado hit. Those reminders are still there today. They can talk about the new normal all you want. But when you've lost everything that, we had, staff and students that lost their home, their church, their school, everything. Mm-hmm. So everything before is just a memory, and mm-hmm. you're still living in that community and just trying to remember how things were.
It's almost a little haunting, you're physically in that same place, but it's not the same place. And there are these layers of loss, like you're describing, landmarks, places, like it's physically been transformed, and families have been transformed. So in all these different communities that you have served, and within your own lived experience, and you and I have talked about this, there's something really amazing that I think we have discovered that people have within them, that communities have within them, that I think doesn't get talked about enough. And these are the ingredients of resilience. These are the things it takes to rebuild. And a lot of them come from ingredients that were there before. And we refer to them as protective factors professionally. So let's talk about some of the protective factors that you have seen that have served individuals or that have served communities. What are the things that, when they look back and they go, man, I'm really glad we had X, or wow, we're so fortunate that we had already established Y. There are some amazing protective factors that can be real difference makers for communities like those that you're serving in long-term disaster. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things I saw in terms of just recovery, one of the greatest protective factors are the relationships, the people around them, and what kind of relationships they have. So it's really hard to build relationships when you're in the midst of a disaster. And so having those pre-need relationships established is really a protective factor. So how your schools engage with the churches and the human service agencies and the business community and all those relationships and interactions and those strong ties and connections, and just being able to pick up the phone and calling the CEO of the electric company because you have a relationship with them because they've been engaged in some school work, and being able to get power to a school that without that connection, it would have made our ability to recover as a school system that much more difficult. When people know your heart, know the way you think, and have spent a lot of time with you, and you've built all those connections and relationships from a whole community approach to recovery, it really takes that. And you have to have those before a crisis. And so one of the best pieces of advice I give to any community is make sure that you know how all these people that you think about, okay, what would happen if we had an EF5 tornado roll through our community and destroy several of our schools? Who would I need to have a relationship with get our schools back online again? Who are those people? Who are those organizations? Your county emergency manager, the newspaper reporters, the producers of the TV stations, the
Department of Public Works.
Yeah, the Department of Public Works, like, city. I mean, all those people that you're going to need to have a relationship with, because there's going to be issues that come up that they're going to need to be solved. And even being able to get a permit to build, or getting somebody to come out from the city to inspect a school that's under construction to make sure that we're on the right track. And you just got to have those relationships to help kind of grease the wheels, if you will.
And your counterparts too, right? Counterparts, you know, in nearby towns and even states that you can tap for resources. You don't even have to explain yourself. You don't even have to introduce yourself or do the work of establishing a relationship. It's already there.
Yeah. A great example of that is in our case, from a communication standpoint, we just joined the National School Public Relations Association. And because of that connection and relationship, they sent people to help with the communication side of things, which is a key. I mean, in terms of that long-term recovery, short-term and long-term recovery is how you communicate, and to have those extra hands to help with, you know, just making social media posts and things of that nature. Yeah, that was a big deal for us.
That's a great example. You mentioned Bright Futures, though, too. And for listeners joining us that don't know about our Bright Futures program, it's not like it was established with the intention of helping you recover from a tornado. You know, that wasn't like the original intention there. And yet it served the community in ways that you could never, I think, have imagined. And we saw that with Bright Futures communities in the pandemic as well. They already had these pre-need relationships. So when the world was upside down and inside out, all they had to do was pick up the phone, send a text, and needs were met just like that. So talk a little bit about Bright Futures, if you would, because I think that's a great example of a really formidable protective factor in and of itself.
We talk about in the disaster recovery world is taking this whole community approach to recovery. And to do that, though, you have to have relationships in place. And unbeknownst to us, before the disaster, we started this work around Bright Futures, engaging the Time, Talent, and Treasure, our faith community businesses and human service agencies, and working alongside the schools and the families. And through those partnerships that we established to meet the needs of our kids on a day-to-day basis, with the goal of always trying to meet our kids' needs within 24 hours of the need being identified. Because we were making those connections and establishing those new relationships and aligning resources and having systems in place to take in donations, to manage volunteers, you know, all the things that we had in place prior to the disaster. And when the disaster hit, it made a huge difference because we had all these systems in place. And when the donations started pouring in, we just put everything on steroids at that point. We just put the volunteers to work that were coming in, and we just did what we always did, but we just did it bigger and more.
Because in our community, we had a couple of natural disasters, an ice storm and a hurricane that wiped out power and roads and things like that. Fortunately, not of the magnitude of, you know, what we would later suffer and what, you know, you guys experienced in Joplin with the EF5. But it did kind of carve the first cuts of the paths, if you will. Like, people already kind of had some of those relationships established because they had relied on each other in such short order to manage everybody's needs through that time. But the systems, as you described, we did not have systems in place for the volume of donations that would come in. And we just didn't even have an understanding of how to handle that and how long that was going to go. And finally, I think through guidance that our community leaders sought from other communities who'd been through this process, they learned we can say no. We don't have to keep, you know, taking all these teddy bears, because then we have to figure out where we're going to warehouse them, and people have to sort and people have to make sure they're safe. And it was just extraordinary. So systems, just having those systems in place, and Bright Futures creates those kind of natural pathways, relationships, and systems for being able to get stuff in the hands of people, but also connections to resources for some of that long-term healing, connections to services, even through those relationships.
Yeah, those needs are going to be there for a long time.
definitely something to think about in the work is, what are you doing as a community to build those protective factors? What sort of resiliency building are you doing within the community, establishing connectedness and relationships, and even more practically systems and programs like Bright Futures to make sure that we don't have to miss a beat? We can just shift right into high gear, doing the same thing that we should be doing every day in our communities, but more in the aftermath of a crisis. Well, this has been fascinating to dig into with you, CJ. This is a good moment for us to get some words of wisdom from you. So give us the sound off on long-term disaster recovery for the school community. If there's one or two things that listeners can walk away with to be able to take back to their school communities, what do you want them to take?
Two primary things, I think, and we've touched on this a lot, but the whole recovery, it is a marathon, and you gotta pace yourself. And it's important to recognize again that everybody's on their own recovery journey, and we have to respect wherever it is that they are in that journey. And with that, and that's kind of my last piece of advice and something, you know, I share with every community I work with, you know, school boards and administrators, and then start sharing with teachers. How often I hear this word start being used. I always talk about the importance of grace. Giving one another grace during this time. And when we're tired, we get cranky. Maybe we say things we don't mean or do things that don't make sense. I think it's really important in a community following a disaster that everybody gives each other grace and recognizing the amount of work that's gone into the recovery effort on every individual's part, and being willing to forgive and understand that we're all in this thing together, and it's going to take some time, and we're going to have to be patient. And as I said, to start this conversation, every disaster starts local and ends local, and it's those local relationships that's going to carry the day.
Well said. Well, this has been CJ Huff here with us on The Sound Off. Thanks, CJ.
You bet. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this powerful episode of The Sound Off with Dr. CJ Huff. Thank you to our season sponsor, The Door Security and Safety Foundation, for supporting this podcast. And thank you for listening and supporting our mission. Remember, school safety is a collective responsibility, and together we can make a difference. Subscribe now to The Sound Off to stay informed and be part of the movement for safe and sound schools. Until next time, stay safe, everybody. Stay safe and sound.